Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I'm a television critic for such publications as the New York Times, baby, Rolling Stone, Vulture, and the New York Observer. For several of these outlets, I cover Game of Thrones. I am the co-author of the official annotated A Game of Thrones with series editor Anne Grohl and Westeros.org's Elio Garcia Jr. And I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones website located at boiledleather.com, which is the humble host of this podcast. And with me, as always, is my illustrious co-host,
Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. So, we today have a quick one, but I hope it's an interesting one. And way back in the day, it's actually May 11th, so sorry for all the time that has passed since. We conducted a poll for our Patreons because we reached, on our very illustrious Patreon, we reached a stepstone. And we allowed the Patreons to vote for a topic which we should tackle. And the winner of that poll was the request that we'll do another episode like the one we did way, way back in the day when we tried to analyze some theories that are out there for their narrative value, strictly. So we don't look exactly at the text and try to find some evidence and cues and quotes and all that kind of stuff. There is a host of websites out there that is really digging this if you're interested in that. What we are trying to do is simply to look at it. How would any given theory fit within the larger terms of the narrative? What makes sense? What feels right to us anyway? And of course, that's all highly subjective. So please take everything with a grain of salt. And with that, we are jumping directly with both feet in the theory of everything, analyzing popular theories from a narrative and thematic perspective, part two, because we're suckers for titles. Okay. And of course, for the selection of the theories, we also asked our Patreons for input, and we will simply go through anything that we received. And unfortunately, this isn't that much, so we will keep it a little bit shorter than the last time around. But if there is interest in this kind of stuff, we will surely do part three as well.
I would just like to interject at this point that if you would like to get in on this kind of action, the way to do that is to go to patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour and become a patron of the show. Just kick in, I think it's at the $5 level. You can participate in things like this, but any amount really helps. And you can see we have various rewards, various thresholds that if we meet them, we get better equipment, better, we can record more frequently, all kinds of cool things. And it really helps us out a lot since both of us have other jobs that we need to do. So patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. Don't delay. Join today. Become a patron. Support the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. Yeah, I'm quite a salesman when I need to be. So, but yeah, so that's where the topic came from, and that's where all the questions we're going to tackle came from. So it's pretty cool.
Okay, so with that said, let's jump right into the first of the theories that we should have a look at today. And this one is, I guess, a little bit inspired by the events that transpired in season 6. And the theory goes by the catchy Bran Stark equals Bran Stark. And what this means is that basically all the historic Brandon Starks, like Brandon the Builder and Brandon the Shipwright and Brandon the Burner and Brandon the, I don't know, Gluttonous and whatever, that they're all basically the same person, because at one point or the other, Bran time traveled into them and possessed them and let them do stuff, you know? That would obviously happen someplace down the road, most likely in the epilogue of A Dream of Spring. But this is a theory that has gained some traction with the events of season 6. So it is fair that we tackle it now. So what do you think, Sean? Is it likely that Brandon Stark of today will become Brandon the Builder of 8,000 years ago?
I think it's unlikely for several reasons. One is a plausibility reason, which, you know, as Stefan explained at the beginning of the episode, is actually not where our focus is going to be. We're looking on whether things make sense from a narrative or a thematic perspective. But if your theory is based on the idea that today's Bran is also all the Brans of yesteryear, it sure is lucky that all these people were named Bran for him to jump into. You know, like he didn't, the name was already selected, so it doesn't really make sense. It's not like he's just appearing via a time machine and saying like, hi, everyone, my name is Bran. Today I'm really good at building walls, and next time I show up, I'm really good at building ships. And next time I show up, I'm really good at burning ships. He's, you know, these people ostensibly already exist by the time he wargs into them. So unless he just is going through a genealogical tome and just selecting people named Bran and being like, I'm going to make this one important. Like, it doesn't really make sense. Like, it really just doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. But from a thematic perspective, I'm very, very wary about these sort of big puppet master theories, whether you're talking about Bloodraven or Bran or Euron Greyjoy. I think that removes some of the agency from the characters. You know, obviously we're talking about a series that involves a certain amount of mind reading, mind control, prophecy, visions of the future, visions of the past, flashbacks, all these kinds of things. So, but Martin is always so careful to make prophecies either self-fulfilling or there's room for interpretation. They're predictive, but they're not what's the word I want to look for? Determinative, I guess. There's wiggle room. You know, these things happen because people choose to make them happen. So, and to the extent that we have seen direct meddling in people's lives, it's been localized and low scale and kind of shitty, and it ends in the deaths of people, you know, like provided the Hodor situation works out the same way in the show that same way in the books that it does in the show, which we have every reason to believe that it would. There's an example for you, the theory that Bloodraven controlled the pregnant direwolf and moved it south of the wall so that the Stark kids and Jon would get baby direwolves to raise, which I definitely think happened. Like, it didn't work out so great for the direwolf, did it? So I find the idea that Bran is not only, skin-changing into various people throughout centuries of history, but making them do these massive world historical things, it just doesn't really hold up to me in terms of how that form of magic has operated and what Martin's trying to do with that kind of thing. That's my take on it.
Yeah, I agree, basically. I would add two things to it. We talked about it a little bit when we talked about season six, you know, the larger mystic behind Bran's time travel in this case. And I think the aspect of Bran closing a loop or creating a loop, however you want to see it, with his time warging into Hodor, it seems to be a pretty one-off event, and I really don't see how this would happen without any personal connection to times way past. I mean, he could, of course, be the linchpin of the universe, and he needs to go back and for some reason do stuff so it happens later. But if you use this idea once with Hodor, why would you slap on an epilogue in which Bran does it basically several times over and over and over and over again, so that the background comes into place? This seems like a housekeeping operation more than a narrative function. At least if I read this theory without any context from Martin around it, you know. Second one is the ongoing motive in the books that magic always comes with a hefty, hefty price tag attached. And in this case, of course, it was ruining Hodor's complete life, which is a pretty hefty price for one time warg. So if he does this again to several brands in history, he would need to pay a price, or someone else would need to pay a price every damn time. And it, because if he doesn't, then Magic is simply a powerful Deus Ex Machina tool without any repercussions, and it becomes boring. So there has to be a downside to it. There's always the price to pay. And I don't see how we could have any meaningful price, especially at the end of the story, where this would be placed to do all those time travels.
I agree. And, you know, bringing up Hodor again, as you did, is important because we have an emotional connection to this character. You know, watching Bran surf through the space-time continuum and become various legendary figures, it's not interesting because who are these people to us? They're fairy tales, you know, or they're characters in a history book. So to do this once with Hodor in such a devastating way, and then to do it a million times over just to establish how cool and powerful Bran is, like, I don't get it. So I would say no, for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. So, with that, I think we can safely say that we are both not on board with the Bran Stark equals Bran Stark idea. Mm-hmm. So we can move on to the next, which is phrased a little bit more openly, and is regarding one of the greatest mysteries and question marks, especially if you look at the World of Ice and Fire, where it was literally blotted out. So what could have happened at Summerhall that George wants to keep secret and presumably will be relevant in the remaining novels? And right now, as best as I can see, and as best if I, as I have an overview on the people who are writing meta about Song of Ice and Fire, there is literally nothing in the text that gives us any hints about what really is going down in Summerhall. So this is a case A exhibit for our approach, because we really have to purely speculate, and we have to do so on the merits of story. So what happened at Summerhall?
Man, I have no idea. I kind of want to challenge, though, the basic premise of the question, which is that it'll become relevant in the novels. I'm not sure that it will. I think it'll be relevant in the Dunk and Egg stories. And that's why he's keeping it a secret. I think it'll matter to the extent that everything that goes on in Dunk and Egg matters to the books. But I don't think it's like the Tower of Joy Part 2, where it's central to the books in any way. I really don't even know how this information would be communicated to us, except by Bloodraven, I guess, or Bran. You know, or what's her name? The Ghost of Highheart? Because that was a long time ago. So I don't see it having really a direct bearing on the novels, whatever it is. I think it's more a case of he's keeping it secret because, God bless him. He still has every intention of writing all these Dunk and Egg stories, and I hope he gets to. And that's why he's keeping it a secret.
Okay, but then let's just rephrase it in our minds. So what do you think is the importance of Summerhall, where, of course, Duncan Egg will die? We know they die somehow in the fire, but if it is just they die in the fire, he wouldn't keep it secret. So he does want to do at least something special, right? Else he wouldn't have needed to make such a mystery out of it.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know what it is. I don't have any idea what it is. Do you?
I have an idea, and that is, when Summerhall goes down, I think, if I'm not totally mistaken, Aegon is around 50 and Dunk is around 60. So they are pretty old already. And Summerhall is, of course, the night in which it happens is, of course, the night in which Rhaegar was born.
Yeah.
So I think we can safely assume that Rhaegar's birth is finished when the fire starts, because everything else would be really weird. So
I assume he's born in the middle of the fire. And,
yes.
Yeah, and Dunk saves his mom or something, or saves the baby.
I think he saves the baby. That is my basic idea about it. I think Aegon is pretty much toast more or less instantly. But I guess Dunk has this moment of he could get out, or perhaps he has to decide whether to save the baby or save Egg or whatever. And Egg, being a little bit conscious of stuff, I don't know, orders him to rescue the baby or something. But I think Dunk will essentially die rescuing Rhaegar, or going in back again after he rescued Rhaegar because he prioritized the baby. But in that case, you would also have... again, closed the loop, so to speak, because you would have tie in the Dunk and Egg story in the foundation of the Song of Ice and Fire story. Because for that to happen, you need Rhaegar. So that would make sense, you know, a little bit poetically. There is not much of a connection, but in this moment, of course, it's very strong. The one story ends and the other one begins in the same moment, on the same day, at the same place. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a great point. It's the linchpin. Yeah. Ooh, that gave me the chills, man. That was really well said. Really well said.
Oh, thanks. I'm a little bit proud of myself now.
Yeah, so I think that probably makes the most sense of any theory. That it, you know, I mean, I like I said, I think he wants to keep it secret for the Dunk and Egg stories and not for A Song of Ice and Fire proper. But yeah, you know, it's just a big moment that is where one story ends and another begins, exactly like you said. And he wants to, you know, that's the kind of emotional climax that a writer wants to deploy in the proper way and not as a glorified Wikipedia entry.
Absolutely.
Another mystery solved. Woo.
Another mystery solved. Now we're getting into a little bit more mundane stuff, because the next question is regarding more the politics aspects of something, which is, in this case, would the Golden Company ever support a non-Blackfyre Targaryen? So, like, if, I don't know, Dany shows up and asks to hire them, will they support her, or would they try to murder her the instant, you know?
Well, they're supporting a non-Blackfyre Targaryen right now, as far as they know. I don't think that... Maybe someone in the Golden Company is aware that this isn't the real Aegon. But John Connington isn't. And I assume, like, the vast majority of... You know, it's an army. So it's not like everybody knows he's fake and like, oh, well, we're really just going along with this because he's secretly a Blackfyre. And then when he takes the Iron Throne, we'll take him aside and be like, hey, kid, you got to change the colors of your flag. We have something to tell you. Like, they're supporting one right now. So the answer is yes.
I'm not quite sure that so many of them are out of the loop regarding Aegon's true identity. I always get this weird vibe when John Connington first enters the tent of the Golden Company and he presents Aegon the Sixth as, you know, here he is, the true heir to the Iron Throne, Aegon Targaryen. And everyone reacts weird, and Connington takes this as they already knew, someone told them. But then, of course, John Connington isn't the best reader of men, so he might just be mistaken, and they are more reacting in a not cold but off-putting manner, because they know what he doesn't know. I mean, the people who are in the tent are all the officers. There is no one who isn't really a stakeholder in the company in the tent at that moment. So I think it might be possible that most, if not all of them, do know the truth about it. Well, I mean, the Golden Company, after all, managed to keep invasion plans a secret several times over and execute them. So I think they could bring up the necessary discipline.
That I, you know, that's true. Obviously, military discipline is, you know, if the Soviet counteroffensive against the Nazis can be kept a secret, I suppose the secret can be kept too. But I don't know, my he's there, you know, they're keeping the secret from someone who's like eating with them all day and like shitting in the same latrines, and it just seems different than like keeping a, it seems different from like the kind of military intelligence discipline required to keep your battle plans a secret from your enemy. If a large number of people know, well, anyway, I guess what I would also say is this, even if all the officers know, it can't possibly go wider than that.
No, that of course not.
Right.
I mean, most of the foot soldiers wouldn't give a damn either way.
Well, that was my second point, is that at this juncture, we're so far removed from the Blackfyre rebellions that I think you'd be hard-pressed to find very many people in the world who really give a shit.
Yeah, I think much of it hinges on how Varys and Illyrio sold the plan to the Golden Company. You know, when they brought John Connington in the mix and hooked everyone up? I can easily imagine Varys holding one of his famous monologues and, pointedly asking, hey, how did the last 5 invasions go? Maybe you should change your plan. And I have the great idea for you. You will win, but the downside is you aren't allowed to tell anyone about it. But the upside is you got the spoils.
And this maybe is just a larger problem with the storyline, is that so they will have the satisfaction of knowing they won, but no one else will win. No, they'll have restored a Targaryen. If all goes well, they will have restored a king that they're pretending is an actual Targaryen, but it's in fact a Blackfyre. And so this group of like a dozen dudes will have the satisfaction of knowing they pulled it off, but nobody else will.
You know, the one big problem with the idea that they don't know is what has been hammered into our heads repeatedly over Feast for Crows, which is the Golden Company never, ever breaks a contract. Yet here they are sitting in Volantis, and if they are just in for the money, you know, like, fuck it if it's Targaryen or Blackfyre, then why do they break their contract with Myr? Because they already had the money. So this has to go deeper than that. Well, you know, there is a cause to get behind. And John Connington, of course, assumes in his arrogance that he still has that it's the same cause as his. I mean, how could it be any different? But I think the one thing that really could motivate the Golden Company would be to finally succeed with the Blackfyre.
That's true, but I mean, also... I like the logic here, I think, is really sound. However, I also think, like, well, if you do this, you'll have conquered Westeros. That's a lot. That means more to people than money.
True enough.
You know, so I think that's enough inducement on its own.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. It's a difficult question.
It's a
really
tough one.
Yeah.
It can go either way, because both ways have disadvantages on a narrative level. The one, it requires you to suspend your disbelief a little bit, you know, that they can keep the secret in that tight-knit community. And the other one basically is a little bit nihilistic, you know, like, after all, they are the same mercenaries as everyone else, and they're just in for the money and the glory of conquering Westeros and whatever. So it's a drawback in both cases, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, but what I would also say here is that there's a lot we have yet to learn about the exact nature of Aegon, Varys, Illyrio, the Golden Company. We don't know who half these characters really are, what they're really after. That will clear things up, obviously, you know. So that one of the reasons that one of the things that makes this so complicated is just the amount of unknowns that are still in play.
True. Right.
But I think it's a solid question. Absolutely. I think there's reasons to go in either direction with it.
I think the next one will be quite easy to answer, because it asks, who is the best fool in the books? And if I'm not mistaken, we know a solid 4, which is Moonboy, Ser Dontos, Butterstump, and Mushroom. And really,
Patface.
With those... Huh?
Patface.
Oh, Patchface, of course.
Yeah.
Man, how could I forget Patchface?
Shame on you.
Then it really becomes a contest, because the four I mentioned, it's not a contest, then it's Mushroom. But Mushroom and Patchface makes things interesting.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think Mushroom is a compelling figure historically, because he was obviously way smarter than he let on, and was this sort of, like, political comedian, you know? Like, his book is this kind of broad lampooning of the morals of the court, which I think is pretty fantastic. I'm surprised he's not dead. Did he get killed? Do we ever find out? Was Mushroom executed for his insolence?
I don't think so, no.
Oh, well, good for him. He dodged a bullet or a sword. And then Patchface is great because he's really creepy.
Yes.
So
and
I think,
he's more relevant to our story.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So I think I give it to Patchface.
Yeah, I'd say Patchface edges him out, but I'd rather hang out with Mushroom.
Oh, yes.
There we go. But if
my son ever gets insolent or needs to be punished, Patchface is the way to go. Mushroom is fun to hang around.
I also think an underrated aspect of Patchface, because he's so creepy and menacing and weird, is how funny it is that was the fool that Stannis Baratheon hung out with. Like, that's so perfect. Like,
yeah,
he's just this miserable man with a fool who, like, makes everyone deeply uncomfortable. That's great. I think that's very funny.
Absolutely. The show missed out on him.
Yeah, it's too bad. All right, well, that's another one settled.
Okay. So the next question is one of the minor mysteries that will be solved in the Winds of Winter, which is, what is behind Robert Strong's helmet exactly? The show opted for a big zombie, but in the books right now it's entirely unclear, because there is only the booming voice inside a helmet and no further description. So the two possibilities are, like the show, a zombie, or simply nothing, I guess.
I think his head is in there. I think his head is in there. I don't really see... We're talking about fantasy and this sort of weird, almost science fantasy, or certainly as close as, you know, like that and the pyromancers are how close it gets to, like, science fantasy. But...
I'm sorry, I was wrong, because he has taken the vow of silence.
Yeah, he doesn't speak at all.
There is no sound at all, that's the thing.
Right.
Which would lend itself to having no head.
That's true, but I mean, I don't see how it's walking around without a head, whatever it is. We have no other examples of that.
True enough.
Right? Do we see any headless...
I think it also really looks weird when he ever bangs his head and the helmet falls off accidentally.
Right, and then it's not a cool visual. Unless there's, like, a void there, which seems like a bridge.
You mean like black mist?
Yeah, or like, the fucking, the Nazgul, you know. There's nothing in there. But that seems to me to be like a bridge too far for a character that's essentially Frankenstein's monster. Like,
yeah,
that makes him slightly too cool. It just again, these are really subjective things, but my gut instinct is, like, if you take off Sir Robert Strong's helmet and there's just this black void, you know, of, like, pure evil energy, that makes him too cool. You know, he's
true enough.
And the White Walkers at that point, and
absolutely,
yeah.
And he can scream like a Nazgul.
Right, yeah, so you can't do that. So that I assume he has a head. I assume that the head that was sent to Dorne was the head of one of the dwarfs.
Yes.
That Cersei's been decapitating left, right, and center, or having her, you know, paying for dwarf heads.
I agree.
You know, I think a lot of the confusion arises from the vision that Bran has, where he sees the menacing figures in King's Landing, and one's a lion, and one's a hound, and one is, you know, a giant who takes off his helmet, and there's just thick black blood back there, or something like that. I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me. But I don't think that literally means that if you take off the mountain's helmet, there's now just, like, black evil goo. I think there's a head.
Okay. Now comes a really difficult one. And that is, what exactly woke Denny's dragons? Was it the sacrifice or the magic of Miri Mazdur? Was it Rhaego? Was it Drogo? Was it Denny entering the pyre? Was it the return of magic to the world, or something else entirely? This is really a tough one.
Yeah, I guess I'd kind of go with all of the above. I don't know that you can pinpoint one specific thing. This was just the time that this was destined to happen. So these are the elements that were in play. That's what happened to work. I think if you took... You know, if we really want to be literal-minded about it, I guess what I would say is if you removed any single element from that, none of it would have worked. You know, if Drogo hadn't died, if Rhaego hadn't died, if Miri Mazdur hadn't been killed, if Dany hadn't walked into the flames, if they didn't have a funeral pyre at all, I don't think any of it. You know, I think you needed all those elements probably, but that's just a fancy way of saying, like, this was the time. You know, in other words, it's not a formula. It was just time for Dany to have dragons because she's the prince that was promised. That's what I would say, I guess. What about you?
I would basically agree. The one on which I'm a bit on the fence of those factors that I read down here is Rhaego. Because was he on the pyre? I don't think so. They basically threw him away, right?
Right, he wasn't. So, you know, what I'm thinking is, well, perhaps the idea is that instead of having that child, she had these three children.
Yes.
So it's an indirect substitution. It's not like the Drogo on the pyre or Miri actually being killed on the pyre. Drogo was already dead. So
that's absolutely true. Yeah. I don't think that the actual magic of Miri Mazdur played a large role, as in she did something. I mean, yes, she sang and all, but I don't really think that this played into it. Maybe,
oh, no, yeah, no.
Maybe her blood was a little bit stronger, right, because she was such a strong magi. That might be. Her sacrifice was definitely incredibly important. Only death can pay for life. This has been one of the central lessons that we learned about magic and blood magic in particular.
Right.
So Drogo, I guess, was also very important because what you have in Daenerys 10, when she burns him, she, for an instant, she glimpsed Khal Drogo before her, mounted on his smoky stallion, a flaming lash in hand. And he smiled and the whip snaked down at the pyre hissing. So that seems like it's important and not just a delirious vision of her. And then her entering the pyre because she remains unburned. And Martin has made it clear in So Spake Martin, there is when he said definitely that this was a one-time event, a very special thing, and it wouldn't work again. So, as you said, this is a moment of destiny,
right?
You know, like classic Greek stuff, basically. It was bound to happen. It had to happen. And all of those factors really converged into one big knot of karma or whatever, and unleashed a force, or maybe the force unleashed the event or whatever. This is really hard to pinpoint, but all those things really worked together here, and they created this birth of the dragons moment that either coincides or harbingers or jumpstarts the return of magic to the world.
Yeah. I mean, as we've discussed, I think, on this podcast before, obviously there was magic afoot. You know, the Night's Watch was already dealing with the others and the Whites.
Yes.
You know, and there's other minor examples, I think. You know, the prophecy that Cersei got when she was a kid, that worked. You know, and that was decades ago. So, not quite as many decades ago as it is in the show, but, you know, it was a long time ago before Danny was born. So, but yeah, it's another linchpin moment, sort of, only, you know, and I've described Danny, and I wish I could, I had the post at my fingertips because I was way more articulate in it than I'm about to be, I'm sure. But one of the things I like about Daenerys is this idea that she's this sort of human fulcrum around which, like, these vast forces of magic and history and destiny all kind of, and progress, all kind of, like, swirl around and coalesce and get warped, and, you know, she exerts this, like, Magneto-esque magnetic field for all these things. You know, so can you boil down what specifically did the trick? No, I don't think so. I don't think it really works that way. I will say this. We may get more answers if we ever get a satisfactory explanation for why, alone among all of the prophecies, it seems that the one that the Dosh Kalin had about the stallion that mounts the world didn't pan out. Because I assume we will get an explanation that's not just like, oh, they were wrong, they fucked up. Because that never happens anytime else in the book. So I assume they're going to, they misread the signs and it was, they were talking about her actual dragons.
No,
or they were talking
her.
About her. That's, I think, probably the most likely. You know, there's their sort of magic sonogram technology couldn't tell the difference between the fetus and the mother. That's
or
my
bias.
Guess. What or bias? Indeed, indeed. They do live in a patriarchy, so yeah, that may provide some more answers for this question. It may not. It may simply reinforce what we're saying, which is that it's just. It's Danny's destiny, and it was just that time.
Absolutely.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! So, who is the funniest character in the novels?
This is interesting. Who's the funniest character in the novels?
I mean, Tyrion has to be high up there, because he has so many great lines, which are at least funny when you read them first. Usually they become less funny once you have tore apart all the fabric, you know, and you see the abyss of his soul beneath it. Then they become less funny. But at least on the first read, Tyrion is definitely cracking in.
Yeah, I think Jaime's funny from time to time.
Yeah, but very sardonic.
Yeah, you know, he's funny the way like a bad guy in an 80s movie, like a blonde bully in an 80s movie is funny. I don't know. I guess I feel like it's been a while since I've read them, and the actual that kind of stuff isn't as fresh in my mind.
As a side note, I have the same feeling. I really need to reread the novels in the near future, but right now I simply don't find the time for it. You know,
it's quite an undertaking. You know, it really is. And I kind of assume I'm keeping my powder dry for when they announce a release date for Winds. You know, and then I'll reread them in the run up to that book.
I guess so. Yeah.
That's the kind of thing I think you lose. I don't feel I can speak authoritatively on it without having it right in front of me, particularly because in the intervening time, you've gotten to know the versions of the characters in the show, and you know they have different senses of humor and they're deployed in different ways, and that's a little bit distorting, you know.
Dolores Ed.
Oh yeah, he's pretty good. He's funny.
Same Let's just give it to Dolores Ed for the moment.
Done. He's our man. He's the comedy king of Westeros.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we have two questions left. Both will be quite short, I guess. And the first is a little bit of a paradox in my mind, because the question is, what will be the biggest surprise in The Winds of Winter? How would I know? It wouldn't be a surprise if I knew. So this is kind of hard to answer, you know. But I'm reading the question now as to the casual reader. And not like us exalted amongst men who do podcasts about this stuff.
Right.
And so just the biggest surprise that we think we know about and that will surprise many casual readers. What do you think?
Hmm. This is not going to satisfy anybody. But I just assume that there will be a blow to what we think the narrative is. You know, I think that something will go... Because we've had so much time to pick at it, and I feel like we all have it pretty much on lock in a lot of ways. We know what, quote-unquote, has to happen. And I don't think... You know, one of the whole reasons we started this, the first podcast we did like this, was to reject the idea that Martin was just going to zag every time you expected him to zig, just to keep people on their toes, because that's not the kind of writer he is. He deployed surprise extremely effectively several times, most notably with Ned and the Red Wedding, but that doesn't mean that that's what he's like. He's just going to turn everything you think is how stories are supposed to work on its ear just for the sake of doing it. That's not what he's interested in. So while I'm a little hesitant to suggest he will do something like that again, I kind of figure he will. I kind of figure a character will come out of nowhere and become a huge deal. I figure that our interpretation of how various geopolitical struggles are going to go will be dead wrong for some reason. You know, that's not really a satisfactory answer, I realize, but that's kind of what I assume, that there's just going to be something we didn't think of, you know, and it's going to affect, you know, on a fairly fundamental level, how we thought the story was going to go.
Okay, then I'm going to commit myself a little bit more.
Sure.
I think what it seems to shape out like is that the one big thing, the one big turnaround on a general level, is the fading to the background of the political plot in favor of the metaphysical, the magical plot. And I think this is what we'll see in The Winds of Winter. We still have political stuff to cover, especially in North. And of course, with Aegon's ascendancy, but at the same time, the magical world in which prophecy rules and great rituals are conducted, and ice zombies are marching towards the south, will become more prominent. And I think that Puck Wenton is on to something if he says it will be a character like Euron Greyjoy, you know, as you said, basically out of nowhere, who hijacks the narrative and simply uses this magic to insert himself into an established narrative and to turn it around for his own ends. This I really like his idea of a protagonist who is essentially conscious of the rules of the world he lives in and tries to hijack them. He always compares Euron to Saruman, who also more or less pops out of nowhere as a major antagonist into Two Towers. And I think this could be a reversal that awaits us in The Winds of Winter. It doesn't have to be Euron specifically, although I think this is likely. But playing out in that manner seems to be a big surprise coming up.
That seems fair. Yep.
Okay, and the last question I can answer in one word. So we were asked to discuss how similar all the Arianne chapters that have been released so far are, and if George has lost his touch. No.
No. I mean, reread, you know, just grab any two chapters from somebody's story at random from any of the books. They're going to be similar because they're going to happen in like a close period of time. They'd be dealing with the same shit. That's just how it works, you know? If I recall correctly, the first version of the second Arianne sample chapter was read aloud before it was released in written form. And when it was read aloud, it literally contained passages from the first Arianne sample chapter, which means just that he just hadn't finished writing it and settling on what was going to be where. So that's an issue too. But I mean, I think if you look at any two Catelyn, I mean, that's a bad example because I think she was really just stuck spinning her wheels, but look at any two Catelyn chapters from when she was just sitting around in River Run waiting to hear news about what was going on. Like, it's the same fucking thing over and over. Or Ned and various schemings going on, and
Brienne
and John at the wall. Like, it's the same, because that's what people's experiences are. Like, they're not going to be radically different from chapter to chapter. So I think it's kind of a misguided... I get what you're saying. Like I said, the first version of the second sample chapter literally contained material from the first sample chapter. So in that sense, it's the same thing, and it is repetitive. But I don't think it's any more or less repetitive than... any comparable situation. I mean, look at the Sworn Sword. Like, a lot of what's going on with Arianne in the sample chapters is reminiscent of Dunk. You know, we get to know what Standfast is like, and then we get to know what the Red Widow's like, and we get, you know, it's the same basic structure. And that's within one short story. It's just that, you know, that she's having a set of experiences, and that's that.
Amen, brother.
Woo! I've been wooing a lot during this podcast.
That's good.
It's better than saying interesting. We can agree on that.
Not if it becomes the new thing.
No. Although that would be kind of funny. Like, if I was like, you know, I think this is a really woo-woo character, because they play a really woo role in the narrative. Like, that would be... That's my new catchphrase, maybe.
A new Avuro. I've heard better.
Yeah, okay. Let's back to the drawing board. Well, that wraps up all the questions that we got from
it does for this topic.
And that was, I think that was fun. I like doing these kinds of episodes. So I'm sure we will have another reader or patron poll soon enough, and maybe get a chance to do another one of these bad boys. So if you'd like to participate again, please go to patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour and become a subscriber, become a patron. The podcast will always be free, but every little bit helps a lot, and we're extraordinarily grateful for what you guys have already given us. We really do appreciate it. And it lets us do fun things like this.
What he said. Thank you very much. One of the next episodes, by the way, in terms of a teaser or trailers, to say like this, is we have this, how do you say it? If you pledge $5 or more, you get to pose a question to us. And one of our next podcasts definitely will be answering all those questions that have piled up from the $5 or more crowd. So if you want your question to be in the mix, become a Patreon with $5 or more, as long as it's still hot.
Yeah, baby. All right. And until then, thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.